Well, I want to first say how proud I am to have spent a week with two remarkable people who, you know, when you travel with somebody, you get to see all their bad sides. I haven't really seen that with these people. I mean, they're brilliant, and they're nice, and they're good. And it speaks to the best of our movement. And I see that in people here tonight. We just had a quick dinner with some people like the Yes Magazine people who are providing so much hope. We have a good friend here I want to acknowledge. Dana, can you stand up for a second, who's been working hundreds and hundreds of hours on our Occupation Watch site. We have in this room people who care about other people. And during the dinner, somebody said, we're doing all this, you know, we got all this great stuff going on in Seattle, but it's Seattle. And I feel like that often because I'm from the Bay Area. You know, we do all this great anti-war stuff and resolutions for this. And then sometimes we say, yeah, but it's the Bay Area. And then you think, yeah, that's right. That's where the best of this country is emanating. That's where we get the ideas that we spread around to the rest of the country. That's where we send inspiration to people in other parts of this country. And, of course, what Seattle is best known for in recent years is the World Trade Organization shutdown. And how many people here were involved with that in some way? Wow. Amazing, amazing work you have done here. And amazing how that one event sent waves all around the world, all around the world. So to this day, when I travel to places like I was just in Venezuela, you know, people say to me, oh, Bush, Arfa, were you in Seattle at the WTO when you shut that place down? It still gives inspiration. It still gives hope to people, because people around the world need to hear that force from us saying, we care about the rest of the world. We care about people's lives. We want an economy that's based on human needs and this beautiful environment of ours and not on money. And we want governments that represent our sense of compassion and love to the rest of the world. That's where it all comes from. And when Dan was talking tonight about being in a community, it really rung true to me when you said that, because a lot of us have fought with our religious upbringings, have come to terms or not come to terms with it, but recognize that our movement is spiritual. Our movement is deep. Our movement gives us a sense of community. And it's such a loving movement because we are with people that not only care about our community, we are not the chosen people, we are not number one, but it's a community that loves the rest of the world. And that is indeed beautiful. And how many of you watched the debate last night? Well, it was a very interesting debate. You know, it was also interesting almost as much as what wasn't brought up. The fact that you could talk so long, 90 minutes about the Middle East, and not talk about Israel and Palestine is quite amazing. The fact that you could talk about the Middle East for 90 minutes and not talk about our dependency on oil is quite amazing. The fact that you could hold a debate in Miami and not say a word about Latin America, not mention immigration issues, of course not bring up the issue that the U.S. government tried to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela, not to mention the ongoing embargo of Cuba, not to mention how the failed trade policies of the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, NAFTA, that they're trying to extend all over Latin America, has devastated countries like Argentina. The fact that these issues don't get brought up when we talk about foreign policy is quite extraordinary. But it was good that there was a rather long discussion about Iraq. And one of the most blatant lies that Bush told during the whole 90 minutes for me was when he said, what makes us different from the terrorists is that we think that all life is precious. Now, if he was talking about we in this church, yes. If he was talking about we, raise your hands if you participated in any anti-war protest. If he was talking about that we, yes. But not if he's talking about the we that is the U.S. government. And Dan brought up issues about the last Gulf War. Of course, he could have brought up a lot of issues about Vietnam. But let's take the post-9/11 period and just talk about how the U.S., when we should have been so sensitive to the issue of civilian life and how precious every life is and how wrong it is to take the lives of innocent people, as was done on September 11th, to not learn that lesson from September 11th and actually use September 11th as an excuse to launch military attacks, is absolutely devastating. Starting out with Afghanistan, the, quote, good war, that even Kerry would say was the good war. The good war in Afghanistan. You could have infiltrated al-Qaeda networks. You could have used the intelligence community from Pakistan and all the different countries that sympathized with us after September 11th, infiltrate the cells, try to capture those who we thought were involved, put them before a court like the International Criminal Court that Bush trashed so much last night. That is what should have been done, but instead a bombing campaign. And Kerry made a good little point when he said, oh, we outsourced the job of getting Osama bin Laden to the warlords of Afghanistan. It sounded good. People in the room I was in clapped, but it wasn't true. We didn't outsource that job. We bombed the hell out of that entire region around Tora Bora where we thought Osama was, and everybody said, Osama got out of here long ago because he knew the U.S. was going to start bombing. And who got bombed? Innocent villagers who lived in the poorest places in the entire world. People who never had electricity, who never had running water, who never read a newspaper, who never saw a television. And when we went as Code Pink to visit some of those villages and saw a woman dying on a makeshift clinic bed after six of her children had bled to death and her husband had died, and as she's dying and looks up at us and said, who did this and why? And we said, the U.S. military, they're trying to get Osama bin Laden. And I said, the United States. She said, what is the United States and who is Osama bin Laden? We killed so many people in the bombing of Afghanistan that we know that we killed more than were killed on September 11th. Yet the U.S. military refused to count them, refused to help them, refused to acknowledge them, refused to even say we're sorry. We saw children who were walking through the fields, picking up little bright pieces of yellow that turned out to be cluster bombs, getting their arms blown off. And when we went to the U.S. military and said, can't we give them even medical assistance to get a prosthetic limb? The military said, no, it's not our responsibility. Not our responsibility. And when we took September 11th family members with us to Afghanistan, and they saw the tragedy there, and they came back and lobbied in Congress for months at a time saying, our family members were killed. We don't want to kill other family members. Please, let's help these people. Let's set up an assistance fund. We sat down finally with people from the State Department. They said, the Pentagon will never agree to it because it would set a terrible precedent of taking responsibility for civilian casualties and it would make war too costly. And we said, that's just fine with us. Let's make war too costly. Then let's go to Iraq. Iraq. How many civilians have been killed in Iraq? We have no idea. We're called oftentimes at Global Exchange or Occupation Watch, and they say to us, how many civilian casualties? Like when it came to the grim milestone of 1,000 U.S. soldiers killed, they said, how many Iraqis have been killed? We said, we have no idea. Absolutely no idea. When we set up the Occupation Watch Center in Baghdad, we thought we would start counting. But it got way too out of hand. Couldn't count. Some people say 10,000, some 15, some 20, 25, 30. We have no idea. And what does that say about life being precious? We don't bother to count. We don't bother when they're innocent civilians to even take responsibility. The day we opened the Occupation Watch Center in Baghdad, we held a press conference, and there were people who showed up who weren't press, and we wondered, who are these people? And while we're doing the press conference, they started getting up one by one and saying, I have a story I need to tell, and telling the stories about their family members who were killed by the U.S. military. And this one man dragged us home with him and introduced us to this young widow with her two young children, the elderly grandparents, and told us that when the husband was going to work in the morning as a veterinarian, standing on a street corner trying to get a taxi, a U.S. patrol came by, thought they heard a noise, thought they were being shot at, shot into the street, 10 bullets into his chest, he was dead immediately. They couldn't even find his body. They needed help going from military base to find his body. And when we're there listening to the story, and the widow is crying hysterically, she says, we have family in California. We love the United States. We learned English. We speak English. She said, you know what hurt me the most? They never apologized. They never apologized. She wasn't even asking for money. She wanted a simple apology and couldn't get that. That's how much this government values life. And we see it every day in Iraq. The fact that there was a debate yesterday between a president and presidential candidate, the very day that 34 children were killed in Iraq, to not even recognize it. Yeah, blame it on the insurgents. It was car bombs, suicide bombs. Blame it on them. But at least acknowledge how terrible we feel for the families and the children. Not even a word about it. And of course, no word about the people that we are bombing again in Samarra, in Fallujah, where it's on the third week of the second bombing campaign after April. We destroyed the holiest city in the whole damn country, Najaf. And there we are in the middle of Baghdad. You know, Sadr City is the middle of Baghdad. It's not some like remote desert place. It is Baghdad. We are bombing Baghdad. Of course, that wasn't mentioned during the debate. And who is it that is getting economic gain from all of this? Who is it that when the Iraqi people felt, well, perhaps we're occupied by the richest country in the world, maybe economically our lives will be better, the sanctions will be lifted? No, that didn't happen, because their assets overseas, their oil money, and our tax dollars didn't go to Iraqis to rebuild their own country, went to U.S. corporations. And the biggest, baddest one of all was the one that used to be run by Dick Cheney from 1995 to 2000. And he comes back into the White House and the Bush administration, and he brings in Halliburton even before we have declared war. March 8th, before war was declared, they secretly get a $7 billion no-bid contract to rebuild the oil supplies of a country we hadn't even publicly said we were going to attack. Halliburton is synonymous with corporate welfare, with corruption, with fraud, I would say with evil, as George Bush likes to say. But Halliburton also had 45 of its own employees killed in Iraq. Now you would think perhaps Halliburton would think about the lives of its own employees. Well, we as Code Pink bought shares in Halliburton, and we started talking to the other shareholders, and we wrote letters to the other shareholders, and we said, don't you think it's bad business when 45 of your own employees get killed? Whether or not you care about what's happening to Iraq and the war profiteering and all of that, what about your own employees' lives? And don't you think as shareholders we should do something about it? Well, most of the shareholders didn't care until the campaign against Halliburton got bigger and bigger and bigger. And Congress, thank goodness to people like Henry Waxman, started doing some hearings. And we at Code Pink went through the halls of Congress dressed as big fat Halabacon costumes, as pigs, going up to every congressperson, shaking their hands and saying, thanks for the $7 billion in taxpayers' money. Can't we get a couple of billion more? And we went to Houston at the shareholder meeting when they said, oh, you can't organize in Houston. You're from the Bay Area. You don't understand. People don't protest in Houston. And there we were on a weekday at 9 o'clock in the morning when the Halliburton shareholder was meeting, and we had 300 people dressed as pigs outside the shareholder meeting. And finally, just last week, the news broke that all of this bad publicity for Halliburton has been a nightmare for them, and that it has meant that the shareholders are starting to shy away, that new investors are not buying in, and their shares are actually going down. Well, Halliburton wasn't concerned about the lives of its 45 employees. But it is concerned about the price of their shares. And so now they're saying that they are going to sell off that division that's doing the contracting in Iraq, Kellogg, Brown, and Root. We are delighted that they'll be selling off that division, but we will be even more delighted when we see that entire corporation, just like Enron, go under. Well, who else is dying in Iraq? Of course, U.S. soldiers. And it was interesting that neither Bush nor Kerry talked about them. It only came up in the question that Lehrer asked. Didn't even bother to talk about the over 1,000 U.S. soldiers. And we as Code Pink were in front of the debate at the University of Miami with coffins representing those who had died in the month of September, 76 soldiers, to show that every month the numbers are going up and up and up. And doesn't that tell you something about this war being unwinnable? And doesn't that tell you something about the grief and the agony that is coming from this war? And shouldn't we be talking, as Kerry mentioned last night, dividing the war from the warriors and recognizing that the people who are fighting in Iraq are also victims of George Bush's war based on lies, that the people fighting in Iraq, predominantly from poor families, predominantly from rural areas where they have no options except for low-paid minimum wage jobs. Predominantly, if there's one ethnic group that is disproportionately represented, it's the Latino community, because they go around the border areas enticing people to go into the military as a way to get citizenship for their families. And, of course, there is one thing that holds most of the people who join the military together these days, and that is the simple goal that they have of getting a college education. And when you talk about life being precious and how much we value young people in this country, what does it say that we have allowed the cost of education to go beyond reach for the majority of people in this country? Doubled in the last 10 years. What does it say that we are spending three times the entire federal education budget on this war in Iraq? What does it say when we say to our young people, ah, you want to get an education? Think about risking your own life or risk killing somebody else. No. Our movement values young people and says that we believe in this, the richest country in the world. Anybody who wants an education should get it for free. And now I want to talk about resistance in our country, because I am proud of the resistance in our country. And some of the loudest, most eloquent voices have been the voices of people in military families themselves. The voices like people like Fernando Suarez, whose son died in Iraq. They told him his son was killed by enemy fire. It turned out his son stepped on a U.S. cluster bomb and bled to death. And this father was so angry, he went with us to Iraq. He came home, left his job as a cashier at 7-Eleven, and goes from high school to high school all along the border regions to say to young Latinos, Do not be cannon fodder in George Bush's war. You might have heard Sue Nieder from New Jersey, who when Laura Bush was speaking got inside, and when Laura Bush talked about the war in Iraq praising her husband, she said, "Laura, send your twins to Iraq. Don't send our children. If your daughters support daddy's campaign, let them support daddy's war." And if you saw Fahrenheit 9/11, you saw Lila Lipscomb breaking down in front of the White House, talking about the agony of her son's death, and now going all around the country in the depths of that agony and taking that around to other people and saying, "I don't want you mothers to suffer what I have suffered. And there's only one way to do that, and that is to stop this occupation and bring the troops home now." And it's not only the families, it's the soldiers themselves, like Camilo Mejia, who after 8 months serving in Iraq came home for a 2-week furlough, said, "I cannot keep fighting in a war where innocent civilians are killed every day, where people are being tortured in the prisons. I will not go back." And even though they denied him conscientious objector status, he is holding his head up high as he serves out his sentence in Fort Sills as a deserter, encourages others to say the same thing. Stop fighting this illegal, immoral war. Join with the new group that has been formed, Iraqi Veterans Against the War, a growing group of young people saying no. We saw our resistance movement in all its glory in New York City during the Republican convention. How many of you were there? Thank you for going a long way from home to get there. Thank you for not listening to the reports of the Bush administration about the code red, orange alert, not listening to the mayor of New York City who said we can't have Central Park, not listening to the press in New York that said watch out, Weather Underground, the Black Panthers, all these groups are coming back out and there's going to be mayhem in the streets, don't come to New York. And despite all of that, the day before the Republican convention opened, 500,000 people on the streets saying no to the Bush agenda. We've talked tonight about the election coming up. I think that we have a new correlation of forces after the debate last night. I think Kerry did much better than Bush. That is at least, even the corporate media has had to recognize that. I think it's given a new sense of urgency to the campaign. But I think there was a lot going on under the radar screen that the polls didn't pick up. And that is all the people who are going to the swing states and registering people to vote, young people who never voted before, infrequent voters who are determined this time to vote, youth groups like League of Pissed Off Voters, they're all over this country. Women's groups like Code Pink that never got a manicure in our lives and are going to all the nail salons to try to find those single women and register them to vote. There is a lot of organizing going around this country. I think on November 2nd, we're going to see that the results of all of that organizing. I don't know, though, if this administration will allow itself to be defeated. How many people worry about that? So we have a plan of an urgent response network, and I think this is what Dan was referring to when he says that, well, when last time around, when there was a stolen election, and I was in Florida, and people there were ready to get out on the streets. They wanted to get on the streets, especially in the black churches and the unions. They said, come on, let's take to the streets. The Democratic Party leadership said, no, this is not for people power. We will take this to the courts. This time we say, we will not allow this to be decided in the courts. If there is a stolen election this time around, we will take it to the streets. community, you can help lead the way. We will be putting up a pledge on the United for Peace website. Please sign up that pledge, pass it around, pick the place where you will meet up on November 3rd. And if indeed there is a stolen election, this is not a protest for one day or 2 days. This is an ongoing protest until we see some justice done. And let us remember, when we say justice done, when we talk about this election, we have so much we need to do in this country to hold our head up high and call ourselves a democracy. Norman talked about the need for instant runoff voting. We know that we need public financing of campaigns. We know that we need to end the felon disenfranchisement of 6 million of our brothers and sisters. We know we need same-day voter registration. We know we need a holiday for the day of voting. We know we need all kinds of changes in our system so that we can have a multi-party system, so that we can have real debates with lots of differences of opinion. But we are in the process of moving in that direction. And November 2nd is one step in that process. And when Norman said the world should have a chance to vote on November 2nd, the world is looking at us. And they are watching us, and they are waiting for our results. They are waiting for the verdict. They want to hear on November 2nd that we understand that the face of this Bush administration towards the rest of the world has not been one of precious life, has not been one of compassion, has not been one of love, has not been one of kindness. The face that this Bush administration has given to the rest of the world is bunker buster bombs, cluster bombs, Apache helicopters. We will keep all our weapons of mass destruction, but you can't have yours. The face of hypocrisy, the face of aggression. And that is what is making us so unsafe in this world. So let us recognize, on November 2nd, we are determined to get Bush out of the White House, and past November 2nd, we are determined to build a global consciousness in this country so that people recognize it's not a football game, it's not about us first. It is about recognizing that a child in Afghanistan is as precious as a child in Iraq, is as precious as our own children, and we will keep fighting and working until we have a country that represents the beauty of our world community. Thank you very much.